NPR senior producer Devar Ardalan got a phone call about a year ago. It eventually led to this discovery that Devar's grandmother, Helen Jeffries, had been honored by a tribe in Iran. They'd named a mountain for her.
When I was growing up, my grandmother Helen used to hum this song. It's called Debalol, and it's a folk song the Bakhtiaris like to sing when they make their migration twice a year to find pasture for their flocks of sheep and goats. Their journey takes them across brilliant mountains and the frigid waters of the Karun River. My grandmother went along with the tribe once in the 1950s and described how they shepherded their flocks across seemingly vertical walls of rock and crossed the rivers on inflated goat skin lashed together. My grandmother would also tell me the story of her youth, how as the daughter of conservative Baptists from Boise, Idaho, she ended up in Iran as a public health nurse. She was part of President Truman's Point 4 program that sent American experts to work in some of the poor and remote villages around the world. Here's an excerpt from a radio interview she did in 1958.
And what we were trying to do was to make a survey to find out what health problems were most prevalent in Iran, what the conditions were, and what the most prevalent diseases were.
In one instance, Helen single-handedly convinced a reluctant cleric to allow the women in his village to attend her prenatal class. And then there was the village of Khoshkirud, which means dry river.
When we finally left the village, the people said to me, "You have given us hope." And when our engineers were able to put a shallow well in this village so the people would have a proper drinking water, they said, "And with water, you have given us life."
The Bakhtiaris became a permanent part of Helen's life when she defied convention and married an Iranian doctor 30 years her senior. My grandfather was born in a village in the Bakhtiari region, and when she fell in love with him, she fell in love with the tribe. Helen's life was all about breaking down barriers. She died in 1973 and is buried in Tus near the tomb of a legendary Persian poet named Ferdowsi. She didn't live to witness the 1979 Iranian Revolution, the embassy hostage-taking ordeal, or today's tensions. All of these events would have devastated her. I've never seen the mountain that's named after her, but now I know that somewhere in the Chaharmahal Bakhtiari region of Iran, Mount Helen stands as a monument to selflessness.
NPR's Devar Ardalan. To read Helen Jeffrey Bakhtiari's journal entry about crossing the mountains with Iran's Bakhtiari tribe, you can go to our website, npr.org. This is NPR News. Melanie Roach doesn't fit the image of a championship weightlifter. The self-described girly girl fancies fuchsia-painted fingernails and makeup. She weighs just 117 pounds, but she's lifted 249 pounds over her head, a U.S. record in her weight class. Today, the mother of three is preparing for the Beijing Olympics and getting inspiration from her autistic son. NPR's Wendy Kaufman has her story.
What Melanie Roach likes best about weightlifting is that she alone controls the outcome. Her opponent never changes. 200 pounds on the bar is always 200 pounds.
As I walk up to the chalk bowl, and I'm stepping in the rosin and chalking up, I'm staring that bar down as if it were a person or an opponent that way. And it's amazing how much energy you can muster up when you know there's a weight on there that you've done before, but it's this moment, this time, is what counts.
This is Melanie Roach, second attempt.
The recent Olympic trials at Georgia Tech had a theatrical quality about them. And as Roach mounted the stage for the event called the Clean and Jerk, the music and the crowd grew quiet. Earrings dangling, she reached down, pulled the nearly 240-pound bar to her chest, and squatted. And with that, the 33-year-old from Bonnie Lake, Washington, raised the bar up over her head, triumphantly completing the lift that would earn her the number one spot on the U.S. women's Olympic weightlifting team. Moments later, when she was greeted by family and friends, tears were streaming down her face.
You did it!
Mommy! Congratulations!
Go
Rich was expected to make the Olympic team in 2000, but a severe back injury forced her to call it quits. Over the next 5 years, she and her husband, Dan Roach, a Washington state legislator, opened a large gymnastics center and had three children. When the youngest was just a month old, she told her husband she wanted to return to competitive lifting. He wasn't surprised.
She had a really rough time in 98, 99, and 2000. So she had a lot of, you know, ghosts sort of haunting her. And I always knew she wanted to go back and be able to have that shot of, you know, doing what she knew she could do.
But within weeks, their life would turn upside down. Their son, Drew, then 2 years old, was diagnosed as autistic.
How do you spell down?
D-O-U-N-D.
D-O-W-N-D.
The early morning get ready for school routine at the Roaches' home is a whirlwind. Breakfast and a last-minute spelling quiz, all the while attending to Drew. Things such as tying his shoes or combing his hair require extraordinary compassion and patience.
Do you want to do it or do you want Mommy to do it? Say, Mommy do it.
Mommy do it.
Mommy do it.
Roach hopes that by talking about Drew's autism, it will spur more research and assistance for families affected by it. Melanie Roach admits that for several months after Drew's diagnosis, she was, as she puts it, borderline depressed. A devout Mormon, Roach prayed Drew would get better. Finally, in tears, she went to her bishop.
I looked at him and I just shook my head and I said, you know what? This is not what I signed up for. And with a smile on his face, he firmly said, "No, Melanie, this is exactly what you signed up for." And he went on to say that he knew that the Lord trusted me with Drew and that he knew I would take good care of him and that Drew knows that I can handle this. And boy, I tell you, that was the turning point for me.
Roach says instead of focusing on what Drew couldn't do, she began to truly embrace who he was, living in the moment with him, not dwelling on the past or the future.
And I really feel like that concept of enjoying the now and not worrying about the future is what my coach has been trying to teach me for 14 years. And that is what has made me such a different athlete 10 years later. That is what has made me strong enough mentally to make this Olympic team.
The champion lifter took a few days off following the Olympic trials, time to savor the victory and let her body recover. But it wasn't long before she was back at work in the gym. After wrapping her ankles and donning a weight belt, she reached down and, with muscles fully engaged, grabbed the barbell.
You know, once you get to that point where you're focusing on technique, it's not really about how heavy it is, it's just about trying to do it right. It's about getting more out of your body than you ever thought was possible.
Wendy Kaufman, NPR News.
And for pictures of Melanie Roach, you can go to our website, nprnews.org. Albert Eiler was a renegade even for the 1960s, a modest man with a wild saxophone style that exploded into dense jazz improvisations. His playing foresaw the hardcore punk and alternative rock styles of more recent times. In fact, a new generation of mostly rock fans is discovering Eiler's music thanks to the reissue of the original recording, several tribute CDs, and a new documentary. Howard Mandel prepared this report.
My name is Albert Eiler. I played back when I was about 8 years old. My father, he made me play the saxophone and so forth.
These words open Albert Eiler's 1963 debut, My Name is Albert Eiler. They're also in the new Swedish documentary of the same title.
I had always wanted to come to the Scandinavian countries. I'd heard a lot about the Scandinavian people.
The film's director, Casper Collin, thought there was a good story in the Black American's apprenticeship touring Sweden with dance bands in 1962. The confusion his intense originality prompted for musicians and listeners alike, and his triumphant return to Northern Europe as a headliner with the touring Newport Jazz Festival in 1966. Casper Collin was unsure, though, of how to create a portrait of this musician found floating in New York's East River, evidently a suicide, just 4 years later. Then he discovered some extraordinary footage.
And that is the beautiful shot of Albert naked from his chest and up, It's like a 30 or 40 seconds long shot, but he's just looking into the camera. And he has beautiful, burning eyes. This was in 1998, and I strongly remember when seeing this for the first time. You know, I had been listening to his music for quite a long time, and then seeing him looking at you, it was very, very moving. So I kind of decided then, if this is the only footage, we try to make at least a small film.
Instead of a small film, Colin persisted in his research and came up with a 79-minute movie. He interviewed Eiler's Swedish colleagues and girlfriend, his American collaborators, including drummer Sonny Murray and bassist Gary Peacock, and eventually traveled to Cleveland to meet Eiler's then 89-year-old father and his surviving brother. The film My Name is Albert Eiler depicts a man of pure vision and aesthetic daring, mostly misunderstood in the jazz world, the pride and despair of his family and friends.
I was living pure frustration like a madman, like a madman. I was up in my room when I went to Cleveland playing, and I was beating like this on the floor. Then I go downstairs. My mother said to me, "I don't think you are my child." When I was in the hospital, the man must have made a mistake and give me the wrong baby. Made me cry. I cried, but I thought I'd say, nobody understands what music, what I'm trying to do, and I'm trying to understand it. And it was like very shaky situation.
Eiler's mix of ingenuous simplicity and improvisational fervor has found a hard core of fans. Mark Rebo, one of the most acclaimed progressive guitarists on the New York scene, comes out of a rock, rhythm and blues, and no-wave background, and asserts that Eiler's language is a jazz beyond jazz.
The chord language of his compositions goes between the tonal language of spirituals, of military marches, and occasionally of blues. It goes between there and pretty dense atonality without ever stopping in between at bebop, let's say.
Mark Rebo put together this band called Spiritual Unity to celebrate and transform Eiler's music. Vinnie Golia, a composer and multi-instrumentalist at the center of the Los Angeles post-jazz scene, is one of the voices on another tribute album, Healing Force, the songs of Albert Eiler. Vinnie Golia was a painter, not a musician, when he first heard Albert Eiler in Greenwich Village in the late 1960s. He, too, says Eiler's music has the energy of punk and gospel.
That just sweeps over you, that energy. You don't care if they're playing two chords or what. You know, it's just the energy and the commitment to playing that way.
Albert Eiler's ferocity and commitment do not make for easy listening, but Vinnie Golia says a little effort can open your ears.
That music can lift you up, but there's a point where you become fatigued. And if you can break through that little wall, your listening opens up into this other level, and it really becomes quite astounding. You start to hear the logic, just the intent of how the person is playing. And so that lifts you to this other place, which I find is, man, you know, I mean, it's quite exhilarating, you know, and you want to stay there, not only as a player, but as a listener.
Oh, let it come in. Oh, let it come in.
For most of his career, Albert Eiler was shunned, ridiculed, or ignored. Yet by the time of this 1964 interview, he'd become certain about what he was doing.
The music that we're playing now is just a different kind of blues. It's the real blues. It's the new blues. And the people must listen to this music because they'll be hearing it all the time. Because if it's not me, it'll be someone else that's playing it. Because this is the only way that's left for the musicians to play. All the other ways have been explored.
Eiler's ambitions may be a little closer to realization, says filmmaker Casper Collin.
Maybe he did not really succeed in the way he wanted when he was living, but the interest in his music is much, much bigger today. I think there's a lot of people coming to this kind of music from more alternative rock music. It's not really a jazz thing, really, but I think that there's a lot more open-minded people today.
Collin's faith echoes Eiler's own.
One day, everything will be as it should be.
Until then, the film My Name is Albert Eiler is showing at art houses across the country, tribute projects proliferate, and Eiler's own recordings have been reissued. For NPR News, I'm Howard Mandel in New York.
And you can hear full songs from Albert Eiler and more in the music section of our website, npr.org. This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. How do you keep a mouse out of the house if he really wants to come in? A new book for children called A Visitor for Bear explores exactly that old question. It's written by Bonnie Becker and illustrated by Katie McDonald Denton. Daniel Pinkwater is our ambassador to the world of children's literature, and he's brought us this fine gem. He joins us from his home in upstate New York. Daniel, thanks so much for being with us.
Hi, Scott.
You'd think that a big old bear could keep a little mouse out of his house, right?
Well, have you noticed, I sure have noticed, and I'm responsible for some of it, how bears infest children's literature. Even the logo of the publisher, Candlewick Press, that published this book that we're going to do today, a bear.
Oh, yes, I just see that.
The three bears, the popular Berenstain Bears, a wonderful classic children's book, The Bear That Wasn't Paddington Bear.
Mm-hmm.
I have a theory about this.
Yeah, okay.
I just made it up. To a little child, bears and adult humans bear a certain resemblance. I think it might be very entertaining to see a bear, read adult human, behaving in a ridiculous manner in a book.
Yeah, because to children, adults are big and lumbering and not always sensible like
bears. And bad-smelling and everything else.
Yes.
The first time this occurred to me is when I got this little polar puppy, this little Inuit dog who you've met, Lulu.
Yeah.
And when she was quite small, I discovered that if I did the sort of Frankenstein walk, she took it very seriously. And I thought, oh, she thinks I turned into a bear.
You could be onto something.
I don't know. Sometimes I am, and sometimes I'm not.
Well, we'll hear from people.
But, we should just read this very entertaining book. It's A Visitor for Bear.
Mm-hmm.
And do we toss a coin, or just whoever feels moved starts reading?
Oh, I by all means, you begin.
No one ever came to Bear's house. It had always been that way, and Bear was quite sure he didn't like visitors. He even had a sign, "No visitors allowed."
One morning, Bear heard a tap, tap, tapping on his front door.
When he opened his door, there was a mouse, small and gray and bright-eyed. "No visitors allowed," Bear said, pointing to the sign. "Go away."
He closed the door and went back to the business of making his breakfast.
He set out one cup and one spoon.
But when he opened the cupboard to get one bowl,
there was the mouse, small and gray and bright-eyed.
And in fact, here we do see the bear looking
very surprised.
Exactly. And the apron tied around his belly hardly goes, right?
Yeah.
It's a nice little touch.
"I told you to leave," cried the bear.
"Perhaps we could have just a spot of tea,"
said the mouse. "Out,"
commanded the bear.
"No, sorry,"
said the mouse.
"I'll be going now."
Bear showed him to the door and shut it firmly.
Then he went back to the business of making his breakfast.
But when he opened the bread drawer for one slice of bread,
there was the mouse, small and gray and bright-eyed. Bear pointed a rigid claw toward the door.
"Yes, then, here I go,"
said the mouse.
"Farewell."
And the mouse whisked out the door.
This time, before he went back to the business of making his breakfast, Bear shut the door very, very, very firmly, locked it,
boarded the windows shut,
stopped up the chimney,
and even plugged the drain in the bathtub.
Carefully, Bear set about the business of making his breakfast. He opened the cupboard. No mouse.
Ah.
He opened the bread drawer. Nothing.
Whew.
He opened the fridge. Mouse free.
Yes, indeed.
He lifted the lid to the tea kettle.
There was the mouse!
Small and gray, and well, you know the rest. Bear fell to the floor and wept.
I give up, he blubbered. You win. I am undone.
So sorry,
said the mouse.
But perhaps if I could have just a bit of cheese and a cup of tea, and you think we could unstop at a chimney and have a nice fire?
Bear blew his nose with a loud honk.
Then you must go,
he sniffled.
No visitors allowed.
You have my word,
said the mouse.
Bear unshuttered and unboarded the windows.
Unlocked the door.
Unstoppered the chimney.
And unplugged the drain.
He brought out two plates of cheese and two teacups, and he made a crackling fire in the fireplace for two sets of toes. The mouse warmed his feet and nibbled and sipped, and Bear did too.
They sat for a long while. The clock in Bear's house ticked loudly.
Bear cleared his throat.
The mouse looked most attentive. No one had ever been most attentive to Bear. The fire is nice,
Bear announced.
Lovely,
said the mouse.
No one had ever said Bear's fires were lovely.
I can do a headstand,
said Bear.
Very impressive,
exclaimed the mouse.
The mouse set down his teacup. Bear quickly lifted the teapot.
There's plenty more, he said.
So sorry,
said the mouse.
Most kind, but I must be on my way.
Really, you needn't go,
said Bear.
I am off,
said the mouse, springing up from his chair. Wait,
cried Bear, but the mouse stepped out the door.
Toodaloo,
said the mouse. Don't go,
wailed Bear, throwing his body across the path.
But I gave you me word,
said the mouse, pointing at the no visitors sign. Oh, that,
cried Bear, pulling down the sign and tearing it up.
That's for salesmen, not for friends.
Not for friends?
Asked the mouse, small and gray and bright-eyed.
Bear nodded. The mouse's bright eyes glowed brighter. Bear smiled.
Do you like one lump or two?
Said Bear, most politely.
I like two,
said the mouse, and Bear agreed. Sweet boy.
I love this story.
The illustrations are nice. The bear is expressive. They have a wonderful sort of idyllic country cottage that the bear lives in. And the mouse, of course, is bright-eyed and all that.
Yeah, I love the picture of the bear standing on his head, by the way, just for a joke. It's a very nice book, Daniel. Thanks so much for bringing it to our attention.
It's a pleasure to handle goods like this, Scott. Mm.
The book is A Visitor for Bear by Bonnie Becker, illustrated by Katie McDonald Denton. Daniel Pinkwater is the author of many fine books for children and for adults. His latest is Bear's Picture, which incidentally is also one of his oldest. So for the rest of that bear tale, you can come to our website, NPR.org. Read all about it. I'm going to venture a little political analysis this morning. Many people have made comparisons between Senator Barack Obama, who's now won the Democratic presidential nomination, and John F. Kennedy. I don't find those comparisons wrong, but maybe a little rosy. I think there are similarities, but not the ones many people think. In death, John F. Kennedy became the image of a young, smart, and charming chief executive that many Americans still hold as an ideal. But in life, Mr. Kennedy was elected by one of the smallest margins in U.S. history, one that could even be disputed today. He wasn't the candidate of youth or even his generation. Richard Nixon was just 5 years older. They'd both served in World War II. John Kennedy, it should be remembered, campaigned as a saber-rattler who would challenge the Soviet Union in Berlin, Cuba, and building more missiles. Nixon was the candidate who urged caution. Jack Kennedy was the candidate of big city bosses like Richard J. Daley, an old-line Southern Democratic segregationist. Lyndon Johnson was demonstrably more supportive of civil rights. At the time he ran for president, John Kennedy had more experience in public office than Senator Obama, but Mr. Obama is the more accomplished orator. John Kennedy was nominated in 1960. Many found his speaking style flat and clipped. He wasn't considered as eloquent as Adlai Stevenson or Hubert Humphrey. But I see both John Kennedy and Barack Obama as clear-eyed, cool-headed, unsentimental big city politicians. Many pundits have said Mr. Obama's campaign caught the tenor of the times, a desire for change. But Senator Clinton won almost as many votes as a candidate of experience. I think the Obama campaign schooled in big city ward politics, invested time and effort in caucuses, which gave them a string of victories. Senator Clinton relied on winning big state primaries, and did, but couldn't overcome the semblance of a rising tide for Senator Obama. He is a shrewd and deliberate politician who will put an American flag lapel pin on, take it off, and put one on again. In the rough and tumble of Chicago, he became an ally of the Dailies without alienating the Jacksons. He cut ties with unhelpful friends, including his pastor. Senators Kennedy and Obama both were the first members of their religion or race to win a major party presidential nomination, but you would rarely hear that from them. Part of that may be the humility of knowing they are the beneficiaries of progress in America, but shrewd politicians also know that their identity is part of their personal story and appeal. A politician makes unapologetic use of his or her identity, just as they do being rich or handsome. Barack Obama supporters see his nomination as opening a Kennedy-style new frontier. But it doesn't detract from his achievement to note that each man made history by playing old-school big city politics. This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. William Wilberforce was an abolitionist, a legislator, friend of the mighty, and foe of powerful forces. He was also the life of the party, a genial host, and an evangelical in a time when bringing religion into politics made many suspicious. William Wilberforce used his political skills as well as his principles to move the mighty British Empire to not only ban the slave trade, but enlisted the Royal Navy, then the strongest military force on earth, to enforce it. A new biography of Wilberforce has just been published. The author's also been a famous legislator for most of his life, once and perhaps once again rumored to be a future prime minister. William Hague, from Yorkshire, like William Wilberforce, is now the Shadow Foreign Secretary of Britain's Conservative Party and was once head of his party and a famous boy orator in politics. Mr. Hague's new book is William Wilberforce, The Life of the Great Anti-Slave Trade Campaigner. He joined us from New York last week when my voice was a little under the weather. Thanks so much for being with us.
It's a huge pleasure. Thank you.
What intrigued you about Wilberforce? Well, we should explain, you've done a previous biography about his good friend, William Pitt.
Well, that was where I started off, really. I wrote the book on William Pitt, the youngest ever British Prime Minister. He was Prime Minister at the age of 24. And, of course, when you write about someone, you meet their friends. You feel as if you meet their friends. And one of his great friends was this man, William Wilberforce. Pitt became the ultimate career politician, prime minister most of his adult life, and he worked and worried and drank himself to death in his 40s. Wilberforce never became prime minister, never became a minister of any kind, but arguably, as a what we call a backbench member of parliament, a junior member of parliament, exercised more influence on history than almost any other British politician in the last few hundred years.
Why was he attracted to politics?
He was drawn to politics, I think, partly because some of his friends were going into politics, and partly because great events were happening at the time. Because when he was in his late teens, the American Revolution was underway, and then a change of government in Britain. And there he was in Parliament, not knowing what to do with his seat in Parliament at the age of 21, having effectively bought his way into Parliament. So then how was he going to use his position in Parliament? And that was what he turned to next.
Describe for us, please, the steel and the animation of his religious principles that made him an evangelical, because it's certainly at the center of this story.
It is at the center. It was really his conversion at the age of 25 to evangelical Christianity, a spiritual and mental experience of enormous power that convinced him he had to use his life for some productive purpose. And that led him to take up the abolition of the slave trade, which many Christian forces had been gathering together to oppose in the previous decades.
I gather in your account that Wilberforce's religious conversion, his becoming an evangelical Christian, broadened and deepened his interests and his commitment, his sense of conviction in life. But he still remained the life of the party, didn't he? This was a guy who was considered scintillating company.
You could easily form the impression that he was a rather over-moralizing, interfering busybody. You know, not only was he taking up all these causes, but he was always thinking about how to turn other people to religion, thinking how to get them to pray. And yet he was saved from being an insufferable bore about all of this by being such vivacious company. And he was happy to talk to anyone from the kings of the time, who certainly King George IV would later seek his company, to the Prime Minister William Pitt, to anyone who happened to be in his home, which was always thronged with visitors who he was too kind to turn away.
Hey, Mr. Haig, you're a pretty famous orator yourself. I remember you were said to be Margaret Thatcher's favorite orator. What were Wilberforce's gifts when he spoke in Parliament?
He spoke in the great age of eloquence in Parliament. You know, these days, whether it be in the US Congress or the British Parliament, the outcome of votes is often known well in advance, and so there is no call for eloquence. But in those days, there were many independent MPs. They could change their minds. So an MP really had to try to win the argument, and this brought forth these brilliantly eloquent speakers, Pitt, Fox, Burke, and Wilberforce. And I go through in one of the chapters of my book, I analyze one of his speeches and show how he used 8 different oratorical techniques in his first great opening oration on the slave trade in 1789, flattering the audience, cunning in presenting the argument, trying to get the audience to come to its own conclusion so they don't think that you have forced it on them. They have worked it out for themselves. All of these techniques of the good orator are there in this textbook example of a good speech.
As you noted as we began to speak, Mr. Haig, William Wilberforce never became Prime Minister, but it would be hard to name more than 2 or 3 Prime Ministers who accomplished more.
Well, that is right. And this is, well, the usual saying is that all political careers end in failure. That's one thing that all British politicians are taught, and indeed it's usually true. But that's only if you think about it in terms of holding power. They're bound to end in failure if you only want to be in power, in government. The great thing and the inspiring thing, one of the inspiring things about William Wilberforce, is that as someone who never held executive power, but was an active legislator with the goal of entrenching for centuries to come certain values and certain enactments, he went to his grave knowing that he had succeeded in doing so, far more fulfilled than the run-of-the-mill politician. And it's that, and his ability to live life as he preached it to others, that really make him stand out among the ranks of politicians and make his life one that we should all know about. Abraham Lincoln said everyone should know about Wilberforce. And so I hope, now my book is published in America, that Americans will obey that injunction.
I have to ask, you've done biographies, Mr. Haig, of both Pitt, who became Prime Minister, and Wilberforce, who didn't. How do you see yourself?
I don't see myself as becoming Prime Minister. I stood for that office in 2001 against Tony Blair. Everyone will remember that he was re-elected. And then I left the front line of politics for a few years, which is where I got going on the writing and on many other things I've always wanted to do. And I have come back now into front line politics, really to support the new leader of my party, David Cameron, who I hope will be the next British Prime Minister, and to be his foreign affairs spokesman and hopefully to serve in government with him after the next election in Britain.
Mr. Haig, so nice to talk to you.
Thank you.
William Haig, former head of Britain's Conservative Party, his new book is William Wilberforce, The Life of the Great Anti-Slave Trade Campaigner.